Last time on the Missouri Review podcast, we presented the first place and first runner-up winners in the voice-only creative nonfiction category of our 2007 audio competition. Today, we continue in that same category with the other runner-up entries. We'll begin with our second runner-up, Randolph Jordan, and his entry, A Death in the Family.
I was 9 years old in June 1965. School had just let out for the summer, and as we finished dinner, we heard the distant clanging of a brass bell. "Mama, can we get some ice cream?" I asked. We were still sitting at the table as my brothers and I finished what was left of our dinner. "Let the boys get some ice cream," my father called out from the living room. It was an unexpected kindness from my father, but none of us waited for him to change his mind. Running in to see him, he handed each of us a nickel. Just as quickly, we continued out the front door towards the small white truck parked on the gravel road in front of our house. "Tell the man what you want," Ricky said, hurrying me along. "Do you want a Nutty Buddy or a Fudgesicle?" "I'm thinking," I answered. "Come on, Randy," he said again. "Can I have a brown mule?" I asked the ice cream man. Without answering, he puffed a big cloud of bluish smoke, and for a brief moment, the short, fat man with a smelly cigar became almost angelic, as if he had descended from another world, just for me and my brothers. "Here you go, boy," he said in a gruff voice. I gave him my nickel. It was a good day. After dinner, it was always a bath and in bed by 7 o'clock. That was one of the things that made me realize our family was different from others. No matter what time of year it was, we had to be in bed by 7. But this night was to be different from most others. It was around 3 o'clock in the morning when I woke up. "What's wrong?" I asked, still half asleep. "Shh," Ronnie whispered. Woven throughout our words were the sounds of dishes breaking and my parents screaming. After a long few minutes, the crashing and screaming finally stopped. Ronnie, Ricky, and I climbed out of bed and made our way to the living room. There my father lay collapsed in a heap on the vinyl couch. As we stood in the doorway, my mother beckoned us to come closer. "Tell your daddy you love him," she said. "Go on. Give him a kiss and tell him you love him." Looking towards our mother, we could see 1,000 pieces of broken bone china on the floor behind her. Fragments of cups and plates. A wedding gift from long ago. What had moments before been the only beautiful thing my mother ever owned was now nothing more than shards of broken glass. I walked over and kissed my father on the forehead. "I love you, Ran," he slurred as he kissed me. The smell of whiskey and vomit blew into my face. The next morning, Daddy left before my brothers and I got up. No one said a word about what had happened a few hours earlier. In the weeks that followed, it became our duty not to talk about it. For their part, Ronnie and Ricky continued to escape in their own way, always looking for someplace else to be. And my friend Bobby and I looked for new ways to exercise our dominion over the world around us as well. One morning, Bobby showed up at my front door, standing there in short pants, which was unusual for him. His legs had pink welts from his shins up to just above his knees. I didn't have to ask what they were or where they'd come from. "What do you want to do?" I asked. "Let's go find something," he said. "Like what?" I asked again. "There's some blue jay nests in the pine woods," he explained. "I want to see if we can get them." As we wandered down the narrow dirt path to the pine woods, we noticed a large dark object moving slowly just ahead. It was a snapping turtle. With that realization, we started screaming with excitement. It was a magnificent creature, a good 25 pounds. Bobby reached under the turtle's shell and flipped it onto its back. "You grab the legs," he said, pointing to the front claws. "I ain't grabbing those things," I answered. "It'll rip me up." "All right," he said. "I'll get the front and you get the back." "Hurry up," he said. "Get it before it gets right side up." "I'll grab the tail," I answered. As we struggled to haul it up the hill towards our homes, we finally decided we'd carried it far enough. "Get your brothers," Bobby told me as we dropped the snapper squarely on its stomach. "I'll make sure it doesn't get away." Within a few minutes, I was back with Ronnie and Ricky. The four of us stood there gawking at the creature. We each took turns poking at it, wondering what to do next. Finally, Bobby pulled his hatchet from its sheath and began to tap lightly on the top of the turtle's back. "We could take it to my grandma and she could make it turtle soup," Bobby said. With the turtle's fate decided, each of us launched a series of brutal jabs and kicks. Finally, Bobby took the hatchet and gave the first awful thwack. We all stood stunned, amazed at the gash the blade had made in the creature's armor. Soon we began taking turns, wielding blow upon blow. First, a front leg was chopped off. Then we each took turns hacking into the turtle's back. We were like a pack of wild dogs ripping and tearing at the carcass of a helpless deer. Our voices became shrieks of laughter as we jerked and pulled at the creature. Finally, I kicked the turtle over on its back and began hacking away into the underbelly. And within a moment, the turtle was dead. The frenzy ended just as quickly as it had begun. Bobby threw the carcass into a nearby ditch. Slowly, each boy left, returning to the thing from which he had been called away. And just as my brothers and I never spoke about the things that happened in our house, just as Bobby never spoke about the whippings he received from his daddy, we didn't speak about the turtle or any of the other creatures we tortured. Instead, we spoke about the things we held dear, like the clanging of a brass bell on a hot summer day.
Our third runner-up was Angela Cervantes with her entry, A House of Women.
A House of Women by Angela Cervantes. We are all women here. I know this because Gloria, the mother of the house, lays her artificial breasts around without a care. The breast is a perky mound of beige rubber that fits into Gloria's bra to replace the left breast she lost to cancer. She uses it so no one outside the house knows what she has lost and what she has survived. Once I found the breast on the dining room table where it jiggled like a gelatin mold any time anyone walked through. One night, it found me. I was sitting on the couch watching a Mexican soap opera when I noticed something fleshy pressing against my thigh. Lo and behold, it was the breast. I gently picked it up and moved it to the TV stand and wondered if Gloria would come looking for it. Sometimes she did. She looked for it the same way one looked for their car keys or eyeglasses right before leaving the house. It is uncomfortable, too heavy to wear around the house, Gloria always explained, picking it up and taking it to her room. That's all she'd ever say about it. She'd never apologize for leaving it on the toilet seat or on the bookshelf or anywhere for that matter. And why should she? We misplace our things all the time. As a teenager, I lost my retainer 100 times. I would find it in the medicine cabinet, by the phone, and twice in the refrigerator, no thanks to my big sister. Just because this lost and found item is a very realistic body part shouldn't warrant an apology or shame. Losing a breast to cancer is nothing to be ashamed of, and misplacing a portable rubber breast is nothing to be embarrassed about either. For millions of women like Gloria, it is a reality, and for many young women like me, breast cancer is a looming concern. So spotting the artificial breast on the bookshelf, balled up like a spoiled cat, is a constant reminder to do my monthly checkups. Anyway, it never stays in one place for too long. Gloria will walk in, retrieve it with a casual, I swear this thing gets up and walks by itself. This is why I like living with Gloria. She has a good sense of humor about a subject that must have been extremely painful for her, and a subject many women prefer to ignore. I have lived with Gloria and her youngest daughter and 3 other women renting from her for 5 months now. Since arriving to Guadalajara to study Spanish, it's the best place I've found. Gloria started renting rooms out to young women when she was diagnosed with breast cancer, and her husband left her and their 4 children for another woman. Renting out rooms was the only way Gloria could afford cancer treatment and continue feeding her children. Gloria is a natural mother to all the young women who rent from her. She gently inquires about your life and offers advice. She makes you feel like part of the family. On any night of the week, all of us are seated in front of the TV, watching our favorite soap opera and sharing popcorn. Even the breast is there. At least we suspect it is, because even though we can't see it right now, Gloria confesses during commercial break that she's misplaced it again. She's checked her room, the bathroom, the dining room, the kitchen, and the kitchen pantry. It's my sneaking suspicion that it is with us, under one of the cushions, and before the commercial break ends, we will find it, and Gloria will giggle, I need to put a bell on this thing, and stuff it into her bra and be on her way. Again, all of us in the house make a mental note to do a breast exam before we go to bed, because early detection, according to Gloria, makes the difference, and we know she knows what she's talking about.
Thanks for listening to this podcast from the Missouri Review. To find out more information about the Missouri Review and to see a complete list of the winners of our 2007 audio competition, please visit us at www.missourireview.com.